Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. Appropriately enough, my name is Michael Cutler, and I am your host. I'm going to be flying solo this evening. Certainly, your phone calls are welcome. The number to call is 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. Those of you who are familiar with me and with this program know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, if you will. Today, of course, the responsibilities for the enforcement of our immigration laws have been divided up. The job that I used to do is now handled by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and a separate division of ICE, and this name game of leaving immigration out as often as possible. It is now also called HSI, Homeland Security Investigations. God forbid we should create the illusion that we care about our immigration laws. This program primarily focuses on the immigration issue, not entirely, but most of my emphasis is on that, because immigration, as you know, is not a single issue, but rather a singular issue that impacts almost every challenge and threat that the United States of America faces in these difficult and perilous times. For those of you who want to read a little bit more about me and my background at the INS and what a kid from Brooklyn is doing in terms of a radio program and other things that I've done, please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. That's one word, MichaelCutler, michaelcutler.net. I'm also very pleased to have another website called Talk Border, one word, TalkBorder, talkborder.com. As the name of that website implies, it's part of Ann Magazine. I do interviews and I've written some commentaries. Again, the focus there, immigration, border security, or lack thereof, and the way that it impacts so many Americans and so many lawful immigrants on virtually a daily basis. The other website that I want you all to go visit is called capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. That's the terrific website that is sponsored or created by an organization known as Californians for Population Stabilization. Great organization, wonderful people. They are based in Santa Barbara, California, where they always like to boast about the wonderful weather that they routinely have. They talk about another wonderful day in Santa Barbara, and indeed it is a great place to visit. I've been there a number of times, always love being there. But that's what's so remarkable. California has seen up close and in person the impact of illegal immigration, but as goes California, so goes the rest of the country. We are on opposite sides of the country, CAPS and I are, but it does not much matter, because immigration is not just an issue that is of concern to the supposed four border states of California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas, but it is a crisis for every one of our 50 states, and I always like to make the point that all of America's states are border states. In order to qualify to be a border state, all you need is to be along one of our geographical borders, either with Mexico or Canada, or have access to a waterway that ultimately empties out either into the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic or Pacific Oceans, or have an international airport, because these are all the different ways that aliens and cargo enter the United States, both legally and illegally, on a daily basis. So, in my judgment, we can certainly say that all 50 of United States' 50 states are, in fact, border states. And the impact, as I say, is mind-boggling. I want to start out by making a couple of quick observations. You know, we've all been watching, or I'm going to presume most of us have been watching, the Republican convention. Great speakers. It was fun watching Clint Eastwood, but boy, he certainly doesn't look like Dirty Harry much anymore. I'm not sure he could very easily wield that 44 Magnum, but it was great seeing Clint Eastwood speak yesterday. and the speeches by both Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party, and of course Mitt Romney, both very eloquent speakers, but something was missing from what they and the other folks had to say, at least the way it was covered in the news media. Of course, they talked about the need to create jobs. Jobs was the focus of so much of what was discussed at the convention. What's remarkable to me, and if you're familiar with me, you know where this is going, folks, was that there wasn't a single word about the impact of illegal immigration on the labor market. There wasn't a single word about President Obama's, in my judgment, misuse of what he calls prosecutorial discretion. I, as you know, call it prosecutorial deception, to give what undoubtedly will be at least 2 million illegal aliens with employment authorization. You know, it's astonishing to me that the game that keeps getting played is that if you dare to say that we have to enforce immigration laws, we dare to have integrity to the system by which we not only admit aliens into our country, but by which we give them residency and citizenship needs integrity, you become vilified, you become labeled. The common label is to be a bigot, anti-immigrant, nativist, the list goes on. Now, let's be very honest with each other. There certainly are fringe elements who look at immigration with an issue of xenophobia in mind. No two ways about it. Take any issue, and I assure you, you will find some extremists, and you can pick any issue you want, whose attitudes, opinions, goals, objectives, criticisms, whatever you want to look at, are really off the wall. But where I have been throughout this country, and in fact I'm about to head next week to Houston, Texas, I'm not sure what arrangements we'll be making for my program next week. I'll try to get a guest host to fill in for me. But I am heading out. T-Fire, T-F-I-R-E, in Houston, is sponsoring an event, so I will be flying into Houston on Friday evening at about 7 o'clock. Or rather, I'll be flying into Houston Friday evening. I'm not sure what time I get there. I'll be speaking at a dinner that night. And late afternoon on Saturday, I'll be heading back to the Big Apple. We have a breakfast or a brunch event scheduled for Saturday morning. So I'm happy to go around the country and provide my perspectives because it's becoming increasingly difficult to have an honest conversation about immigration and border security. There's a lot of mythology, a lot of accusations, a lot of misstatements, false statements, and downright lies, because so many people are making so much money off of immigration. This past month, Social Contract, which is an online quarterly magazine, they also publish a newspaper, a newsstand magazine, a print magazine, The Social Contract, has one of my articles in it. It's a pretty long one, and I called it Immigration, the Modern Day Gold Rush. And we looked at all the people who are literally and figuratively, in some cases, making out like bandits. It's the foreign governments that want the remittances and want to export the potential for insurrection, and it's not just Mexico. It's the corporations looking for cheap labor. It's the advocacy groups who see money and membership and power in getting more and more people into the United States. It's the banks who become the silent partner of the illegal aliens who send remittances home, and those remittances are significant. Mexico gets over $20 billion every year from its illegal alien citizens working in the United States. More money flows to Mexico and elsewhere from the drug trade and criminal enterprises. It's safe to say that when you look at all the money that's leaving America, we're probably bleeding about $100 billion every year because we won't control our borders, because we do bring in foreign workers when, frankly, American workers would certainly be able to do the job. But that, of course, would deprive, and God forbid we should deprive, some attorneys their legal fees who are eager to make certain, as there was stated in a documentary or a covert video that Lou Dobbs had aired a while back, and I've posted it on my website and in my articles, where this lawyer stood there and said, this may sound strange, but our job is to make sure that no Americans get the jobs. And the jobs he was referring to were the high-tech jobs, computer programmers, technicians, engineers, and so forth. Very remarkable. So the immigration system is now a very big trough with lots of people feeding off of it, then the average American is paying the price, whether it's loss of a job, whether it's loss of his life or a loved one. Because our immigration laws only exist for two purposes, believe it or not. You'd never know it to listen to the rancorous arguments, if you want to call it that, posed by the other side. Our immigration laws are supposed to protect American lives and protect Americans' jobs. That's why we have immigration laws. Prior to the Second World War, the enforcement and administration of the immigration laws fell to the Labor Department. That's how we grew the middle class. That's how we developed the American dream. That's how America became a superpower and the envy of the world. Because the government of the United States of America, by the prior generation, the greatest generation, made certain to protect American workers of every race, religion, ethnicity, protect those American workers from unfair foreign competition. Today, of course, they can't bring enough foreign workers into this country fast enough. And what does this do? It causes Americans to lose their jobs. It causes Americans to lose their houses. This isn't about scapegoating immigrants. My family is loaded with immigrants. My mother, may she rest in peace, came to America as a young teenage girl, worked in an umbrella factory for $3 a week, lived alone in a rooming house. She was a legal immigrant. My dad's parents came to the United States from Russia at the turn of the last century. They came here legally. They built their lives here in the United States. That is wonderful. And we admit more than 1.1 million lawful immigrants each and every year. Should we allow immigrants to come to America? Absolutely. Am I against legal immigration? No, but there's a qualifier. The legal system lacks integrity. I just wrote an article for CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. We're going to get into it in a minute, about how the drug cartels are having shootouts, not in Mexico, but here in the United States, and not in the so-called four border states, you know, California, New Mexico, Texas, or Arizona, but in Chicago. In Chicago. So understand the issue. By not securing our borders, not enforcing our laws, bullets are flying in Chicago, Illinois, and the violence is spreading. And we'll talk about what I wrote in a couple of minutes, but you should know there's another article that I wrote for CAPS, and I'm breathlessly awaiting my friends over there, Gretchen in particular. If you're listening, I wish you, Gretchen and Joe and everybody over there, great weekend coming up, Labor Day weekend. But the article that I wrote is about how there's no integrity to the process by which students are admitted into the United States. When you talk about schools, everyone gets dewy-eyed. They say, oh, Harvard, Yale, Princeton. And by the way, I'd love to know why we don't do more to get American kids into those schools, especially disadvantaged kids who maybe can't afford the tuition but are brilliant. Being poor doesn't make you stupid. Being poor doesn't make you inept. Being poor may make you hungry. And being poor creates an incentive to do better. And if we don't provide young American children of every race, every religion, every ethnicity with a legitimate way of elevating their stature in our society, then all too often what we see are these kids who are motivated to break out of the vicious cycle of poverty, filth, and violence as they turn to crime. We need to provide viable opportunities for American kids so that they, too, can write the next American success story. And that depends on their ability to acquire the skills and the education. And then, of course, we have Alan Greenspan, who referred to Americans with skills as the privileged elite. So for those of you out there who are perhaps a tradesman like my dad was, he was a plumber by trade, as he would have said. So for you plumbers and carpenters and bricklayers and auto mechanics and aircraft mechanics, Alan Greenspan thinks you're part of the privileged elite. That's what he said when he testified for Chuck Schumer April 30th, 2009, before a Senate Immigration Subcommittee hearing. He said that the goal should be to eliminate inequality in wages between Americans who have skills and education and Americans who have no skills. So in other words, the ideal world that Alan Greenspan is trying so desperately to create. And he's well on his way to doing this, by the way, folks, if you haven't noticed. is that a high school dropout should not make much more than a guy with a PhD doing cancer research. If that doesn't blow your mind, check for a pulse or a straight line EEG, because goodness, you need to be brain dead to not be alarmed that this is what this idiot has to say. I was on a radio show a couple days after I saw Greenspan testify for Chuck Schumer, and the host asked me what I thought of Alan Greenspan, and I was so angry at this character, and I still am. What he spouts is as anti-American as it gets, as against the American dream as it gets. And I said that when I watched him testify, I felt as though I was seeing a first, the first time I'd ever seen anybody testify before the United States Senate while suffering from rigor mortis. You get the idea about what I think of this guy. It was such an outrage because it turns everything that we learned as kids on its ear. My mother had a fourth grade education. My dad had an eighth grade education. But from the time I was 5 years old, they pounded it into my head, you are going to college. Sadly, they both died before I graduated from college. I wish they had been in the audience. But I got my degree. Because to them, an education was the key to success in America, and it has been. And then we have Alan Greenspan going before a Senate Immigration Subcommittee hearing, bemoaning the fact that we're paying too much money to Americans who have skills or education, and the solution that he sees is to increase immigration quotas so that these Americans, these privileged elite Americans, will not make much more than somebody who, I guess, dropped out of high school. And if you don't believe me, read my articles. Go to capsweb.org. Go to michaelcutler.net. This is an obscenity. It's bizarre. I mean, if you want to talk about somebody who's off in the twilight zone, it's Alan Greenspan. This was the guy who also in 2005 boasted how he made it possible for illegal aliens, of course he called them immigrants, they used that term indistinguishably because it's part of this vilification process, to get subprime mortgages. When a guy by the name of Stephen McGraw in 2003 went before the House Immigration Subcommittee, where I've testified numerous times, at the time Stephen McGraw was the head of FBI intelligence in Washington, he said that the acceptance of Mexican matricula cards posed a threat to national security. Posed a threat because they were not reliable. There was no way of knowing if the person who had the card was that person, was even a citizen of Mexico. And incredibly, the Treasury Department, just days after they were warned by the FBI, said to the banks, oh, you can ignore the Bureau. The matricula cards are just fine. So I wonder how many people with matricula cards and multiple false identities got credit cards and other loans and then defaulted on those loans, because after all, once they got their hands on the money, why pay it back when you were using a fake name anyway? So Alan Greenspan and his great dream for Americans that we should all be earning, I guess, minimum wage. I assure you, with his house in the Hamptons, Mr. Greenspan is not suffering any economic travails today, nor is his family. But of course, that's for the average American, not for the elitists like Mr. Greenspan. And so now there was this incredible story, and it'll be out, I would hope, in the next week or two over at the CAPS website. Keep checking capsweb.org. I'm sure they'll be posting it soon. But the article went into the fact that there are incredibly 10,000 schools in the United States that are authorized to issue the forms that enable an alien to get a student visa to come to the United States. The GAO did a study and found that there was so many loopholes in the system, so many failings of the system to make certain that these were legitimate schools, that the people running the schools were not themselves illegal aliens, as has been the case in some instances. And they even found, believe it or not, that 38% of flight schools in America were deficient in their reporting requirements. And here we are approaching the 11th anniversary of 9/11. Unbelievable. So the legal system has no integrity to it. No integrity. In 2005 or 2006, according to the GAO, Citizenship and Immigration Services claimed to have lost 111,000 immigration files relating to applications that have been filed by aliens for a wide variety of immigration benefits, including residency and citizenship. 111,000 files purportedly lost. Of those 30,000 files related to applications for naturalization, U.S. citizenship. So the adjudications officers had to fly blind. They had nothing in front of them to look at except the application, and more than likely, they approved a lot of people for citizenship. God only knows if they should have approved them. And in this country, we make just about no distinction between a naturalized citizen and a native-born American citizen. So to think that we're handing out the keys to the kingdom to foreign nationals and there's very little integrity to that process should keep all of us awake at night. But that's exactly what's going on right now. And it's that very same bureaucratic disaster, swamp, if you will, at Citizenship Immigration, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, if I can get the words out, that is now being pressed into action to process what Obama said would be 800,000 applications. The Pew Hispanic Center, the same day that the president said that on June 15th of this year, they said that they estimated it would be 1.4 million. Doris Meisner's group, the Migration Policy Institute, and boy, there's a name you got to love, Migration Policy Institute. When I think of migration, I think of the swallows returning to Capistrano, not about human beings attempting to get across international borders, but the migration, what an innocuous name. She said it would be 1.8 million, and CBS and Fox News are now estimating at least 2 million. I'll up the ante and double it. I wouldn't be shocked if we wound up with 4 million. They will not be doing face-to-face interviews. They will not have the resources to do fraud investigations. And you know, the president, when he did this, as I wrote in my commentary for Fox News Latino, said, well, you know, he did this because Congress failed to act when the DREAM Act and when the comprehensive immigration reform bills were up for vote. Well, they did act. It's not that they failed. They didn't vote present, like somebody we know. They voted no. They voted down bad legislation. But in the newspeak of the current administration, no means they didn't act. They didn't act the way he wanted. They didn't rubber stamp a bad piece of legislation. I testified before four congressional hearings, three in the House, one in the Senate. These bills were train wrecks. In fact, they were so bad that I wrote a commentary for the Washington Times where I said that they should rename comprehensive immigration reform with a more honest and descriptive name. I recommended they call it the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act because we would be required to provide official identity documents to God knows how many millions of illegal aliens who are, as the other side would say, undocumented. Well, what does that mean? It means they don't have any official documentation, reliable documentation, to attest to who they are. So how on earth can you talk about a system like that having integrity? We know that the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 in the aggregate used over 300 false names and variations of false names. We know they gamed the immigration system. That being said, what the president is now doing should really get him the MVP award from Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and any other terrorist organization that's trying to conceal their people here in the United States so they can embed themselves, to use the parlance of the 9/11 commission, to which, by the way, I provided testimony years ago, or as I like to say, hide in plain sight. And then, of course, we have Janet Napolitano telling us, don't worry, children, everything is great, the borders have never been more secured, everything is wonderful, they're not coming, the illegals, and that's because the border is tight. And well, let me tell you a little story. There was an article that I based a commentary on that was most recently posted over at capsweb.org. And the title of this was about the let me just pull this up on my screen while I'm talking about it. The title was The Mexican Drug Cartels Fight Turf Battles in Chicago. In Chicago. And this was posted by CBS News. We're not talking about a tabloid. And we're not even talking about a news organization that takes a conservative, if you want to call it that. I don't even know how this became a conservative issue. I've been registered as a Democrat my whole life. For me, immigration and borders are no more conservative than they're liberal. This is an American issue. Nobody of any reasonable political orientation believes that he or she has signed a suicide pact. Remember why we have immigration laws: protect American lives and protect the jobs of Americans. That's why we have immigration laws. That's why we're supposed to have immigration law enforcement. And so here we have shootouts taking place in Chicago. And what was so remarkable, let me read this quote, and then I'll tell you who said this. Daily turf battles over drugs and distribution, he said — he is Jack Riley, by the way — are turning parts of this Midwest city into a Mexican border town. One of the hardest jobs I've had in the past couple of years is to convince our law enforcement partners that we need an enforcement mentality as if we are on the border. Miles away, Riley says, Mexican cartels have a significant influence in Chicago's gang violence problem. Let's take the gloves off on that, he said. We know that the majority of the drugs here in Chicago, cartels are responsible for. We know that the majority of the murders are gang-related, so it is very clear to see the connection and the role. As it stands now, at least three Mexican cartels are battling over control of billions of dollars of marijuana, cocaine, and increasingly heroin in this city, and that includes the ultra-violent Zetas and the powerful Sinaloa cartel run by its shadowy leader, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Now, this guy Riley, if you wonder who he is, knows from whence he speaks, because Jack Riley, the guy quoted in that article, is the SAC, the special agent in charge of the Chicago Office of the Drug Enforcement Administration. What's also kind of ironic is that when he talks about how Chicago is turning into a border city, guess what Jack Riley's previous assignment was? He was the SAC, the special agent in charge of DEA's office in El Paso, Texas, which is a border city, and in fact, it sits just north of Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, which is arguably the most violent city in all of Mexico. In fact, bullets have been flying into El Paso from Ciudad Juarez as a result of shootouts between rival drug gangs and between police and the drug traffickers. So here's Jack Riley sounding the alarm and saying, listen, folks, Chicago has become a Mexican border town. What's remarkable, though, is that he wanted to create a task force. And he said that this task force includes people from the FBI and ATF and state police and city police and DEA. And you know what was left out? Now, I don't know if Riley left it out by accident, if he left it out purposely, or CBS decided to leave it out willfully. But what was left out was ICE. Because if you realize that it's the Mexican cartels operating in Chicago that are responsible for the drug trafficking and responsible for the violence, why on earth would you leave the enforcement arm of immigration out of the mix? That was my job. In 1988, if you're not familiar with my background, folks, I was the first immigration special agent assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of the New York Office of the Drug Enforcement Administration. I was in that position for nearly 4 years, and then I was promoted to the position of senior special agent, and I was then assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, where I had a desk at DEA, I had a desk for a couple of years up at the FBI, and I had a desk for a bunch of years up at ATF. So I worked with all those agencies. I worked with foreign governments. Because what everybody came to understand rapidly was that the immigration laws are ideal for going after transnational gangsters, criminals, and terrorists. Very often you'd want to take a guy off the street without letting his compadres know that you're looking at them because of narcotics trafficking, because then they scatter to the four winds and you want to get them. So you look for any law you can use to take one of the players off the street and maybe even get the guy to become an informant. best law in the world, immigration law. If the guy was deported and came back illegally by re-entering the United States, by running the border, if that guy was deported because of criminal offenses, he or she is looking at a maximum of 20 years in jail. Remember how Janet Napolitano said, oh, it's not a crime to run the border? Well, not exactly. Yes, if the person's an illegal alien who's never been arrested and prosecuted, has never been charged with unlawful entry into the country and so forth, you're right. She's right. That's not a felony. But for someone who's been previously deported, if they have no criminal history, that reentry is a 2-year felony max. But if they have a criminal conviction that caused their deportation, they face a maximum of 20 years in jail. I worked with Senator Al D'Amato back in the early 80s to see that law get written and enacted. So I'm very familiar with that law, and I've locked up lots of illegal aliens who were guilty of violating that law. Great tool. So you take a guy off the street, you charge him with unlawful reentry. The majority don't get 20 years, but minimally they get 5 or 6 years. And you tell them, look, we could reduce your sentence if you cooperate. And if he doesn't cooperate, at least we got one of the players off the street. Illegal alien with a firearm. That's a 10-year felony. I've made a number of arrests for that crime. Now, again, illegal alien. There's the immigration component. When you go to a judge or a magistrate after you arrest a bad guy, first order of business, bail has to be set. Bail only consists of two issues: risk of flight, danger to the community. If the guy's a drug trafficker, a gang member, he was caught with a firearm, he's charged with rape or assault or armed robbery, obviously he's a threat to the community. He was caught with a large supply of narcotics, he's a threat to the community. But risk of flight's a little bit more difficult. So if we have an illegal alien who's been deported before, came back illegally, maybe failed to show up for an immigration hearing even after he posted a hefty bond, you know, bail. Maybe the guy has been giving false addresses and multiple false names. You've established that this guy is a risk of flight. One of the things I used to do as an immigration agent with the Drug Task Force is to go to these arraignments in federal court or state court and explain the risk of flight that the defendant posed. And almost every time, the evidence that I could provide as an immigration agent caused the bad guy to be remanded without bail, which is a home run. So that the guy was in jail. It wasn't one of these cases where the guy is released and then the next day he's involved in a shootout or a rape or some other vicious, violent crime. No, these guys didn't go anywhere. I made sure that they were glued into a jail cell by using my authority as an immigration agent. If the guy committed fraud in getting a visa to come to the United States, that's another great charge. Most terrorists, by the way, don't get arrested for terrorism. Some do, but you'd be amazed at how many get charged with visa fraud. They lie on the application for a visa so they can gain entrance to the United States, and then you've got a reason to be able to prosecute them for lying on that application. The immigration laws can be indispensable, but you would never know it to listen to the politicians. You'd never know it to listen to the accounts that we hear about the problem of terrorism and transnational gangs in the media. God forbid you should link immigration to criminals or terrorists, and then you become a xenophobe. It is so frustrating, I can't begin to tell you. We are rapidly approaching the 11th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. From an immigration perspective, especially in light of what President Obama has now done with his misuse of prosecutorial discretion that I call prosecutorial deception, and when I spoke before an audience of military leaders, I called it prosecutorial excretion. I was so darn angry. Let me tell you, we are not safer today than we were on September the 10th, 2001. We are providing ample opportunities for terrorists to enter our country and embed themselves in our country and acquire false names that they can use to get jobs, that they can use to gain access to modes of transportation, that they can use fundamentally to attack us. This is not national security. This is a farce, and the risks are real. And if the government doesn't think the risks are real, then I'd love to know why we have this theater that goes on at airports where 85-year-old wheelchair-bound women have been x-rayed and frisked and strip-searched, And a four-year-old little girl wound up in the same situation because just before getting on, leaving the airport area and heading for the airplane, she ran back to her grandmother for one last hug. And that, of course, made her a suspected terrorist. This is theater. This is not national security. I'm all for security. I certainly don't want to wind up with a window seat on a de facto cruise missile because a terrorist got on an airplane. But if we're giving people identity documents and we're not sure as to who they are, if we allow aliens to naturalize and then we allow them to change their names when they do naturalize, which is fine, but then their U.S. passports don't reflect their original name, they are allowed to put themselves in their own witness protection program, then we wind up in a situation, and I've spoken about this before, and I raised this issue when I was with Mike Chertoff, and we both spoke at Chapman Law School. Yes, that Mike Chertoff, former Secretary of Homeland Security, or as I prefer to call DHS, the Department of Homeland Surrender. We actually had a naturalized U.S. citizen who had been born in Lebanon, who had changed his name utterly and completely so that his original name was very Arabic-sounding, his American name was very Anglo-sounding, and then he got a U.S. passport and traveled for 4 years throughout Latin America, Europe, and the Middle East. And when he reentered the United States, an inspector who was very experienced, very sharp, very dedicated, there are so many hardworking people there. The first 4 years of my career, I was an inspector at Kennedy Airport. This very bright guy said to this individual, what was your name before you naturalized? Because it wasn't on the U.S. passport, and it should be, and it absolutely should be. And the guy gave him his original name, and it turned out that it wasn't just that this guy was on some terror watch list, no-fly list. This guy was a wanted international terrorist who was able to gain entry into, from what I was told, over a dozen countries, using a false name, in essence, that we gave him. We provided him with an official U.S. passport, not official like that we give to our government officials, but a bona fide, actual U.S. passport in a new name. And it's not improbable that the countries that admitted him under that new name that he naturalized under would have not let him in if they had known what his original name was. Perhaps they would have arrested him. So we are not only endangering our own safety, but we're endangering the safety of our allies. And why? Why? Because we lack the spine, the will, the integrity to do that which is necessary. We're not the least bit squeamish about patting down four-year-old children and 85-year-old women. But God forbid we should add a second name to a U.S. passport to properly and accurately and completely identify a naturalized U.S. citizen. Astonishing, more than astonishing, infuriating. We're told the borders are secure, and here's Jack Riley, SAC DEA Chicago, saying that Chicago, at least parts of Chicago, are starting to resemble a Mexican border town with all the blood that's flowing. The number of shootouts is staggering. The murders are piling up. And what does Janet Napolitano say? There's no spillover violence. In fact, Fox News Latino asked me to do a story about that because some woman pushing a baby stroller through downtown El Paso, and I've been to El Paso, I know the city well, she's strolling along with a baby in the stroller. Luckily, the round didn't hit the baby. It caught her in the leg, and she's fine. They took her to the hospital. They treated her. She'll live. It could have been far worse. But immediately, Napolitano said, oh, wait a minute. There's no spillover violence. No spillover violence. Tell that to the people that live in Chicago when the gunfire erupts. Tell that to the people in other American cities when the gunfire erupts. Understand something, folks. Lots of the marijuana that's being smoked is not grown in the United States. Some is, some isn't. But I can also tell you that we do not produce cocaine or heroin at all in the United States. So if a drug dealer is selling cocaine or heroin or crack, those poisons came from outside the United States. If our borders were secure, the poisons couldn't come here. That's how you know the border is not secure. You want proof? We're not going to have an argument about whether or not Border Patrol arrests are down or up or sideways because we know those are doctored statistics. We know that they are. When I was on with Neil Cavuto several months ago, he said, well, Mike, you know, the arrests are down, and that means that the border is secure and the people aren't coming. And I said, Neil, to try to figure out how many illegal aliens are present in the United States by purely looking at arrest statistics of the Border Patrol makes about as much sense as taking attendance by asking people not present to raise their hands. So let's forget about the stupidity of the Border Patrol statistics, and we know that those are doctored numbers. I think they probably have the same people cooking their books that cooked Bernie Madoff's books and Enron and all those other thieves. No, let's look at the drugs, because if the drugs are available on streets across America, the border is not secure. If the price of drugs doesn't go up because of supply and demand, and I assure you the demand has not been impacted, and the price stays constant, that means the supply is constant. That means the border has not been secured. And while we're talking about demand, I want to make a point. And I want you to think about this. Think of the food police. Think of the wacky mayor that we are saddled with here in New York City, Mayor Bloomberg. Boy, you got to love this guy. I actually voted for him the first time. My father said that you can make a mistake, but the mistake was a lesson if you didn't repeat the mistake. So I admit I voted for him the first time. But Mayor Bloomberg then ran for a third time. But before he ran for a third term, the law or the procedures in place in New York forbid that sort of thing. And he said anybody that would run for a third term as mayor is disgusting. And then what did he do? He ran for third term. And then what did he say? No one else should ever do this. Just me. Just me, because I'm Mayor Bloomberg. So here's Mayor Bloomberg, who says, kind of like Leona Helmsley, remember that great line? The little people pay taxes, but I don't pay taxes. What applies to me doesn't apply to anyone else, because I'm Michael Bloomberg. That's his philosophy. Wow, takes my breath away. Well, Mayor Bloomberg, on his high horse, probably would scare the hell out of him. He doesn't look like a very brave sort, but it's easy to hide behind other people. But Mayor Bloomberg said, too much salt in the diet. No more 16-ounce drinks. Women have to breastfeed. We're going to hide the formula in hospitals. You know, we're going to lead by crazy decrees. I'm just going to make up the rules, and you're going to have to follow it. We're going to play the game of Simon Says, except in New York it's Michael Says. Not Michael Cutler. Don't confuse me with him. Michael Bloomberg. So what's the game of Michael Bloomberg? He says, too much sugar, no good. Too much salt, no good. Have you ever heard Bloomberg or any other person talk about the dangers of heroin or cocaine? We see pretty graphic commercials for cigarette smoke, and I'm happy they do it. I lost my dad to lung cancer. I was 19. He was 57. Tragically, I literally carried him off his job his last day at work on a construction site. He was a plumber. He smoked 3 packs of Chesterfields a day, and he was exposed to asbestos in the shipyards during the Second World War, and certainly exposed to asbestos in the building trades. And the synergy between cigarettes and asbestos did him in. Horrible, horrible death. I still have nightmares about his passing and my mom's passing of breast cancer just a year later. So do I think it's good to get people to stop smoking? Absolutely. Absolutely. And we see the commercials. People that are, you know, using an artificial voice because their vocal cords have been removed. They show lungs and hearts and all kinds of stuff taken out of cadavers when they're doing the autopsy, and they're showing all the blood vessels are occluded, and they're saying this is from cigarette smoke. Very effective. Very effective. When I was a kid, everybody smoked. Anybody who was, you know, a teenager and up was smoking. And in fact, if you want to think about how effective the anti-smoking campaign has been, think about this. How many of you own a car that has a cigarette lighter and an ashtray in it? It's been years since that's been routine equipment. They joke about how many cup holders are in cars. And they do have electric outlets so you can plug in all sorts of equipment these days. You can recharge your iPhone and your, you know, all kinds of stuff. There's no ashtrays and cigarette lighters. In the old days, if you bought a real fancy car, there were all kinds of cigarette lighters in the back seat. Gone. There's no cigarette smoking on airplanes. Gone. The use of tobacco is way down. When I was a kid, if I swept the sidewalk in front of my house, there were always a gazillion cigarette butts and matches and cigarette packs people would discard, throw it in the gutter. Swiney conduct on their part. But this was so typical to find cigarette butts everywhere. We don't see it anymore. Cigarette smoking has dropped tremendously. Why? Because there has been a concerted effort to educate the public so that they stop smoking. They realize it's not cool, it's dangerous, it's costly, it's a lot of things. Do you think heroin and cocaine is any less deadly or dangerous to your health? Do you think that if there was a similar effort to show people what happens to people that use drugs? You know, one of the toughest things that we confronted doing narcotics investigations was to work with informants who were narcotics addicts. These people were human train wrecks. You were not putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. I remember one guy that we were waiting for. He was supposed to show up at 12 noon. We had federal and state prosecutors. This was up at DEA. We had the FBI. We had the police there. We were all waiting for this informant to show up. Guy never showed up. He was always very unreliable. If you told him 10 o'clock in the morning, he'd show up at 10 o'clock at night. If you told him to be there on Tuesday, he'd show up on Thursday. So we had no idea what was going on with this guy. So after a couple of hours, everybody kind of just shuffled off and left, and we said, well, he's not going to show up. It turned out that this knucklehead, high on drugs, actually got arrested. And how did he get arrested? He was waiting for a bus in one of those bus shelters where you're sheltered from the inclement weather. And in the middle of all these people, women, children, whatever, he took out a rubber thing, tied off his arm, and injected himself with his fix of heroin. And the cop car driving by, they saw this, they arrested him, and we get this phone call. Hey, I'll never forget it from the cops. This guy's claiming to be a DEA informant. Do you know this guy, Joe Smith, whatever his name was? Of course we knew who he was. So there he was in jail because he was oblivious to the fact that he was shooting up in front of about 30 people and a police car that was waiting at a red light. That's how screwed up these people are. I have seen people who were professionals, school teachers, bank vice presidents, get addicted to crack. In one case, the woman became a prostitute, turning tricks in the back of the parking lot of the bank where she used to be the vice president. A former deputy inspector with the Suffolk County Police Department pointed her and the bank out to me and told me this woman's tragic story. She was having problems at home and somehow thought drugs was the answer. Apparently not. So when you see these human train wrecks, when you see what happens to people who smoke crack, who ingest cocaine, who inject heroin, it wouldn't be hard to come up with an effective advertising campaign to dissuade people from doing this to themselves. But there's not a word to be found. Smoke cigarettes, they'll do it. Prescription drugs illegally, yeah, there's an occasional commercial about that. But you tell me the last time you saw a commercial on television warning about heroin or cocaine. Now, I can't prove it, but I think too many people are getting too much money off of that rat poison. People are dying. They're dying from the ill effects of the drugs, and they're dying from the violence perpetrated by the addict desperate for a fix. And they're dying because of the shootouts taking place among rival drug gangs. It's estimated that 70% of all crime, directly or indirectly, is drug-related. And what are we doing to cut down on the demand in America, folks? What exactly are we doing? Nothing. Nothing. But we're being told everything is fine. Don't worry about it. The border is under control. Well, you know what? Just saying it doesn't make it so. When Napolitano, the morning after Captain Underpants, if you remember the guy that was going to bring down that plane in the skies over Detroit on Christmas Day, the next day, Nappy had the nerve, the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, to go before the TV cameras and say the system worked. In fact, I confronted Mike Chertoff and Asa Hutchinson about that when we both spoke at Chapman Law School. We had a memorable limo ride from the Nixon Library to the hotel where we were staying in California back then. And we had this conversation. And I said, you know, I wrote a commentary where I wrote that if hope is not a strategy, then dumb luck is not a success. Napolitano was trying to take credit for the incompetence of the underwear bomber and the fact that a guy on the airplane saw this guy's crotch go on fire. Remarkable. But there's Napolitano saying the system worked. I want to know what system she's talking about. You know, it's almost like an Inspector Clouseau deal, the exploding underwear ploy. What exactly is the system that she said worked? This guy was on an airplane. He had explosives in his drawers, and he set them off, except they didn't blow up, thankfully. The system worked? We can no longer tolerate the lies and the mythology and the accusations and the false statements. There are organizations out there that want to vilify me and others. Dennis Lynch did a film called They Come to America. I was very pleased to have had a role in that film. It's a short role. I'm only there for about 5 or 6 minutes. I have some good friends coming up from North Carolina. They're doing another documentary. We're filming this weekend in New York, and thankfully the weatherman is cooperating. Their film is called Invasion, Freedom Under Fire. They've been down to the Mexican border. I said, well, now you got to come to the New York border. And they're going to be here this evening, in fact. I'm looking forward to having dinner with them. But this film that Dennis Lynch did was balanced. They Come to America shows both sides, why they come and the problems it creates. Anybody affiliated with this film has been branded as being anti-immigrant by certain groups. It's infuriating. It's infuriating. One of the worst things about illegal immigration is exploitation. Who's being exploited? The illegal aliens. I have no argument with people coming here legally. I want the legal system to have integrity. That's a whole other story for another conversation, folks. But the point of the matter is legal immigration has been wonderful for America. It has. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the legal immigration system. I know many other people who would not be here. My first wife died of cancer 26 years ago. Her parents were in concentration camps. Thankfully, they were permitted to legally immigrate to the United States. I have no problem with a lawful immigration system. But the illegal side of it is about exploitation. To say that somebody who wants immigration laws enforced as anti-immigrant is a lie. Because I know that when people come illegally, they are vulnerable and they are subject to terrible, often horrific exploitation. That's one of the reasons that I oppose illegal immigration, because it leaves people vulnerable. To say that I am anti-immigrant because I am opposed to illegal immigration is an accusation like saying that somebody who didn't want to own a slave back in that dark era of U.S. history when slavery passed for business as usual in all too many places throughout our country, well, that's like saying that if you didn't want to own a slave, then you probably didn't like black people. What nonsense. What nonsense. This is about not wanting to see people exploited. And to show you how blatant this whole deal was, and it's both sides of the aisle that have given us this nightmare of immigration. Go back to the Reagan administration, 1986, when they passed IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act. Supposedly, for once and for all, we were going to get a handle on the situation. We were going to make sure that they went after the employers, which is a good thing. Yes, I didn't like just going after the illegals. You know, who's more responsible for prostitution, the hooker or the John? I would argue that both sides of the equation are equally responsible, although under the Obama administration, employers are going to be prosecuted, very small numbers, but they will go after the occasional employer to grab a headline, but they won't do anything with the illegal alien, which is equally screwed up. But the point of the matter is that this is about exploiting people. Because we know that when they had IRCA, the illegal aliens who were suddenly legalized went to their employers with that new card in their hand and said to their boss, you know what, I'm going to keep working for you. I know the job. I know the people I work with. I live near the factory. But I'm not going to work for $5 an hour anymore. And you've got to do something about the fire exit because there's no way of getting out of this building if there's a fire. And you know something? We need air conditioning because during the summer it's 120 degrees on the factory floor. You've got to put in air conditioning. And there's a couple of other little issues, and especially I want to be paid on the books. And you know what happened to those now legal alien workers, folks? Many of them were fired. How do I know? Because I would answer the phone in my office at the Immigration Service, and I cannot begin to tell you how many times I got phone calls, and not just me, my colleagues as well. We would discuss this quite frequently. The phones were ringing off the hook. They were ringing off the hook, and very often the people calling in were newly legalized aliens who said, I lost my job when I asked for prevailing wage, and I asked to be paid on the books, and I asked that they meet minimum safety standards, clear a pathway to the fire escape. Give us some air conditioning because it's over 100 degrees on the factory floor. They were sent walking. But these employers did not do without workers, folks. They simply hired the next wave of illegal aliens, and that's how we wound up in this mess. That's what happened. This didn't happen by magic. This didn't happen because the Starship Enterprise beamed us a bunch of folks from some other country. This happened because the unscrupulous employers simply got rid of their now legalized workers and hired the next wave of illegals. Wanting to have immigration laws enforced serves a bunch of purposes. First and foremost, I worry that terrorists and criminals are getting into the United States. Secondly, I worry that Americans can't find work. During the Republican convention, they talked about, I think the number was 23 million Americans unemployed or underemployed. But not a word was said that the President of the United States now gave at least 2 million illegal aliens equal standing in the labor pool. Remarkable. Remarkable. They've now given 2 million, and I think it's going to be many more than that, competitors the opportunity to compete with Americans and lawful immigrants who can't find jobs, who are losing their homes to foreclosure. CBS did a story about kids living in the back of trucks, and they're scared to death because they're homeless that the authorities will take them from their parents. I was on Curtis Sliwa not long ago. And we got into a discussion about what the president did. And he said, Mike, don't you feel bad for these kids that the president says he's helping? And I said, yes, some of these kids are really in an untenable situation, and I do feel bad for them. I do. But isn't it remarkable that the parents who bring their children through the desert and periling their safety are never prosecuted and charged with endangering the welfare of a child? Drive a car in New York City without putting a seatbelt on a small child and break a couple of traffic laws, you know, run a red light or speed or whatever, not only will you face motor vehicle problems, but you'll be prosecuted and charged with endangering the life and welfare of a child. But I said the problem isn't that we're dealing with a couple of thousand illegal alien kids, because that's something that I would probably agree with helping out. We're talking about millions of people. The likelihood for fraud, it's not even a likelihood. Take it to the bank. There will be tons of fraud, and they're not going to do anything about it. But the other side of this is, why is nobody as concerned about the plight of American kids? And the analogy that I used when I was on Curtis's program was, I said, look, we see about these celebrities who hop into their Lear jets or their Gulfstreams, and they fly 12,000 miles to some third world hellhole of a country to pluck a child out of that disaster to bring them here. And, of course, you have to feel good for that child getting adopted and being brought to America. No argument. It's absolutely a good deed. But here's what I want to know. Why do these folks travel so far to find a child worthy of adoption when you realize how many American children living perhaps not 12,000 miles away, but 12 blocks away or 12 miles away from their mansions are living in squalor, living in abusive foster homes or orphanages, and would give anything to be adopted by a loving family, to have a family they can call their own? Why is that somehow no longer fashionable? When did we become so obsessed with the rest of the world that we ignore our own fellow Americans? You know, we occasionally see these terrible situations where there's a building fire or a ship that sinks, and you see the parent rescue their child, holding their baby to their breast. They go running out of that burning building, and other children perish. Nobody, but nobody, would think to criticize that parent and say, what the heck is wrong with you? You saved your own child? Why didn't you save someone else's child? It's common sense, you would think, that first we look out for our own, and then we see who else we can help. But first we look out for our own. Certainly, if a parent rescues their child and time permits, if they're reasonable, if they're compassionate, if they're sensible, they will try to get some other children out of the building. But first and foremost, the most primal instinct in the world is to take care of your own. Shouldn't we as Americans look at all of our fellow Americans, irrespective of race, irrespective of religion, irrespective of ethnicity, say, listen, Americans first. Let's look out for our own citizens first. Let's build our country first. Let's get Americans back to work. You know, when we're on an airplane and they go through that boring safety lecture, I'm going to cry if somebody else tells me how to put on a seatbelt. My gosh, it's kind of almost funny. But think of the instructions they give you about the oxygen mask. They tell you that if there's a loss in cabin pressure and the oxygen mask is deployed, to put yours on first before you try to help somebody sitting near you. Because if you're unconscious, not only won't you be able to help the other person, now you're going to become a fatality yourself. You're going to become part of the problem. America needs the oxygen mask right now. When 1 in 4 American children and 1 in 6 Americans altogether are living in poverty, I'd love to see someone tell me that America doesn't need the oxygen mask. Let's make America as strong as it needs to be, so we can continue to be a voice for freedom and democracy throughout the world. Because if America is lost, I fear the world is lost. It only makes sense to protect our country, to enforce the immigration laws and secure our borders, not because of a dislike for people from other parts of the world. In fact, we admit people from the four corners of the planet, and I can tell you as a New Yorker, I live in the most diverse city in the United States, if not the world. So this isn't about xenophobia. It's simply about building up our country, providing opportunities for our fellow Americans so that America continue to do what it does best, to be the leader for peace and freedom throughout the world. That's part of why this is so darn important. It's been wonderful spending the last hour with you. I hope that you all have a terrific Labor Day weekend. For those of you who have a job, this being the weekend that we commemorate work, And work is so important. It defines who we are. My mom used to say that we are what we achieve. So I hope that those of you hearing my voice have jobs to go to on, I presume, Tuesday. But meanwhile, I hope that the weatherman smiles on your locale wherever you are, that you spend time with friends and family, go to a barbecue, do something that is pleasing to all of you. But let's remember the importance of getting Americans to celebrate their own Labor Day. I always like to end commentaries by reminding everybody that democracy is not a spectator sport. Indeed, it is not. Please go to my website, michaelcutler.net, talkborder.com, and again, to my friends out there in Santa Barbara, California, at Californians for Population Stabilization, I ask that you go to capsweb.org, check out the articles. If you like what you see, pass those links along to as many folks as you know. Ask them to do the same. Educate yourself on the issues, folks, so that we then know how to make the appropriate demands of our employees, the politicians who claim to represent us. Have a great weekend, everybody. See you soon.